This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Gothic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. It's just me, Andrew, in the shed today, but I am going to be joined by Robert Llewellyn, Crichton in Red Dwarf.
Come in, come in. How lovely to meet you.
And the author of the News From trilogy. And of course, Scrap Heat Challenge and so much more. But we had a great chat all about everything he's up to now, fully charged alive, all that electric car stuff and science fiction he's been writing. And we'll come to that in a second. But I just wanted to say that, sorry, we've been a little bit lax in getting episodes out for you. We do have a lot recorded, but finding the time to edit them is proving a little difficult, largely because I've just started a new job as a lecturer in science communication at the University of the West of England here in Bristol. But, I'll hope to find some time in the evenings to just put some things together for you. And in the interests of not leaving you too long, I just wanted to bring you this. And you probably noticed just at the start of the episode there that we are now part of the Stimulus Network, which is a new network of podcasts coming out of the same kind of vein that we are. I don't think any of them look particularly at science fiction, but go to stimulus.network, www.stimulus.network, download some of them, have a listen. I'm sure you'll find some great podcasts among them. Robert Llewellyn is one of the hosts of Fully Charged, the YouTube series, looking at everything to do with electric cars and renewable energy. He was the presenter on Scrap Heat Challenge on Channel 4 and a similar program over in the US. And, of course, he was Crichton in Red Dwarf, an author of many different books, but my particular favourite being the News From trilogy, which is a utopian science fiction based in a future where everything is powered by wind, solar, green energy. And I love the books and read them a few years ago now. News From Gardenia, News From the Squares, and News From the Clouds. And I can't recommend them highly enough if you want to explore a possible, if not likely, future. I began by asking Robert Llewellyn how he'd gone from Red Dwarf to being an electric car nerd.
Red Dwarf was sort of 10 years, 88 to 98, BBC. And then it sort of stopped because we were going to do the movie in 2001. Very long story, won't bore you with that, because we never made it. And in 98, I started making Scrap Heap Challenge, which was a sort of passion project of mine that I really wanted to do, and didn't think it would work, but it did. And I did that for 10 years. But it was really during that time, so very specifically when we made the American version, Junkyard Wars, exactly the same show but made in California, just because of what was happening in California around that time. So late 90s, early noughties in California was, there were really big moves within the Californian legislature to clean up the air. They had the same problem with air quality as Shanghai, Shenzhen, all the Chinese cities are having now, and Indian cities. Yeah, I mean, really chronic air pollution, which is where, and it was kind of, I learnt by sort of the reverse way around. I saw the results of the attempts to clean up the air, had no idea why anyone would bother, and then worked out why they needed to clean up, because it was even then it was pretty stinky. And the first time I went to LA, which was mid-1980s, I thought I'd caught some sort of lurgy on the plane, because I couldn't see, my throat was sore, I was coughing, and I wasn't ill, I didn't have a cold at the time. And all the people who lived there went, oh man, it's the smog, welcome to LA, you know. And it was ghastly. It was vile. It was like a grey blanket over the whole city. And it wasn't every day. It was on days where the wind was in a certain direction. And they had chronic childhood asthma, really low IQs of kids who live near highways, old people dying of breathing diseases, very high levels of lead that they found in children's blood because of leaded petrol. So they introduced unleaded petrol. They introduced catalytic converters. They introduced ultra low emission vehicles like the Prius. All those things came out of those movements. And so I kind of became aware of that. And being a sort of late developing petrol head, because when I was a teenager, I was vehemently opposed to cars. I grew up obsessed with cars. went to see Motor Racing with my brother, who's worked in motor racing his entire life, loved it all, kind of went off it, because I just thought, living through the oil crisis of the early 70s, it just went, this doesn't work. But it did carry on working extremely well for another 40 years, but there was something there that planted a seed, and I would only ride bikes, catch trains, catch buses. I refused to go in cars, which wasn't difficult because no one I knew had a car. So, you know, it wasn't a big sacrifice. And that eventually wore off, had children, had cars, all those things. And then doing that show in California, I just met a lot of engineers that worked in electric powertrain development. I mean, it was as simple as that. Who were like consultants and judges and competitors on the show. And they'd sort of show me things. And I kind of heard about, this is long time before Tesla, but I heard about incredibly fast electric cars, which was intriguing. Had a ride in a thing called the T-Zero, which was in a museum or on display somewhere. It was a very early experimental, high-powered electric sports car that actually caught fire and destroyed itself about 4 years ago in a museum. So it was a very early iteration of a lithium ion. So it was actually laptop batteries out of Samsung, I think it was, or Sanyo laptops, I think it was Sanyo. Still in their plastic casing, but they soldered together all these batteries in a box. I mean, it's very like scrap heap in a way. That was really sort of homemade, but the drivetrain was what went into the Tesla Roadster. So they were developing that, AC Propulsion, the company were called. And we had a guy from AC Propulsion, I think, was a consultant on one of the shows we did there. So it kind of came in sort of from outside. And I was kind of intrigued but baffled by it. I had a lift in a Prius, which wasn't available in the UK at the time. This would be about 2000. I don't think they came here till sort of early 2000s. They'd been in California a while. And I went, why bother to put an electric motor on next to it? What? It's like weird. Why did you do that? And then, you know, I got a lift in it and it drove away from some traffic lights on Sunset Boulevard without making any noise. And I went, oh, that is weird. You know, it really felt like someone was pulling it with a wire that I couldn't see. It just didn't feel real because we're so used to that, vroom, that noise. And it just went, oh, you know, just moved off. So that stuff kind of intrigued me, but I still didn't. I mean, the only change I made was when I came back to the UK. We had a Volkswagen Golf, sensible, small hatchback, but it was the R32. So it was the kind of stupid boy racer, footballer's car, a lower league footballer's car, because it wasn't a Bentley. I don't know anything about football, but I've had it explained to me. That's a lower league footballer's car with two exhaust pipes, and it was very noisy. I mean, I did love driving. It was great fun, but that was where my head was at then. This would be like 2003, and I traded that car in for a Prius when the Prius first got launched here. So that would be about 2003-04, something like that. Engineers that I worked with on Scrap Heap, all the roughy-tufty engineers, were utterly appalled. I mean, I got no support whatsoever. Because the quote was from a wonderful man called Hadrian, who I'm still in touch with. When I drove in it, he said, last week, he's got a Herefordshire accent, last week you drove out in a proper man's car. Now you've come back in a gay milk float. The previous week I worked out, I'd spent like 24 quid to drive to work in petrol. And in the Prius, it cost like 7. I mean, so it was going from one extreme to another, because the R32 is not an economic car anyway, but it had been re-chipped, which was even more stupid, which meant it had voided the warranty, so it was worth less. But my God, it went like stink. It literally urinated petrol out of its exhaust pipe. I mean, it was chronic. So that was a kind of start of that journey. And it was a combination of that and the emergence of YouTube, the emergence of cheaper cameras, of being able to edit video on a laptop. You know, although I'd grown up in the TV industry where an edit suite was like 180,000 quid. And that was basically two VHS tape machines. It was rubbish. You know, so as that stuff developed, it became plausible to make a show about something I was interested in. And by then, I'd got really interested in not so much the individual cars, you know, that like, oh, this one's good or that one. It was the whole shift, the kind of disruptive shift of that technology really gripped me. And obviously, you know, very early days, I got the first fully electric car in 2009, which is a tiny little thing, a Mitsubishi iMiEV. But it was just extraordinary to drive that and to plug it in at night on a 3-pin domestic plug that was hanging off the wall of my garage. I mean, it wasn't even, it was really rubbish. All that stuff, early stuff. Now I look back, I think, God, I was lucky nothing went wrong. But, you know, we drove that car for a year. We drove, I think, 12,500 miles in a year. It was brilliant. We did, you know, shift. That was with kids and school runs and shopping and all that sort of stuff. It was absolutely amazing. You know, because you could have got into steam cars or hydrogen fuel cell cars, you know, which I have driven many of. But it was the fact that you can charge it at home while you're asleep was really intriguing, because you couldn't do that with a petrol car. And then, so then the next steps were getting solar panels, getting proper car chargers, getting cars that did longer distances. You know, the whole, I've sort of followed the whole industry as it's developed. So we now have two electric cars. One costs half as much as the other. They both do about 250, 270 miles on a charge. We can charge them at home for nothing. Mine's charging now because it's sunny from the solar panels. So it costs nothing to put electricity into it at the moment. You know, so that stuff really changes the whole. It's not just a different car, or I miss the noise, or I've got range anxiety, or I don't have. No one has range anxiety who drives electric cars. Only people who haven't driven them have range anxiety. So all those things now I'm really fascinated with the way you can change. You know, the way the energy industry is changing is really dramatic and very disruptive. It's not all good. Lots of things could go wrong with it, but it's still, you know, it's going to be very messy. The next 20 years are going to be very, a lot of big companies are going to go to the wall, and all kinds of things are going to change.
Who's going to go to the wall?
Well, I think big and old energy companies, old oil companies that aren't changing. So the ones that have sort of seen the future a bit more, Shell, BP, possibly those two are a bit more, you know, proactive. The old sort of American diehard Republican, clean coal, diesel is clean. Those people are doomed. I mean, I don't worry about what they say because it's irrelevant. It's, you know, it doesn't matter what they say. Because now no one argues. No one, even they don't argue that what's the cheapest way of generating electricity. For instance, it's onshore wind. By such a huge margin now, it's there's no economic argument. And generally in a capitalist economy, economics wins. You know, so it's like when phones first came out, I had a mate in the early 1980s who had a big box thing that he would call from. And the cost of that phone was mind boggling. I mean, he was a very wealthy guy, and the phone calls themselves cost like, I called him up on our landline to try it out, and it cost like £4 to talk to him for a few minutes on our phone bill. It was, so who the hell is going to get those? They're stupid. Why would you walk around with a big box with an aerial on it looking like a pillock when you can just use a phone? You know, that was the generally 99% of people thought that's how they thought. And at the time, they were absolutely right. We weren't wrong. It was bloody ridiculous. And the talk time on that phone was 10 minutes and standby was 30.
Right.
So you had to charge it all the time, and it was enormous and heavy, and it had big buttons on it, and it was dreadful, and it only worked in London.
But what I did love very much indeed is the News From trilogy.
Oh, right. Oh, great.
Brilliant idea, beautifully realised, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading them all.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe tell us a bit about it.
Yeah.
And also my question would, follow-on question would obviously be, how close are we to it?
Oh, yeah. In the original pitch I did for it, which was that I read a book when I was a teenager called News From Nowhere by a guy called William Morris, who was around in the sort of late 19th century, early 20th century, who's most famous for his wallpaper. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a trendy thing. In the 1970s, everyone had William Morris wallpaper. It's less common now. So he was a sort of artisan, political activist, craftsman, that sort of. There was a whole kind of reaction against the early Industrial Revolution, and it was all about making things that are, you know. And so he wrote this book called News From Nowhere, which, if memory serves, was set in 1980, where Britain was a kind of completely anarchic, loving country with no economy, with no money, no finance, no banking, and everyone was equal, and it was all wonderful and beautiful. And that was set in 1980, which my memories of 1980 aren't quite like that. So I didn't want to set a book that was one of the sort of my internal jokes. I'll do it 200 years in the future so that it's safer. Some of the things that I suggested, you know, they're already happening in a way, you know, that buildings will be able to power themselves. That's not a kind of science fantasy. I think one of the interesting ones was the notion of international travel, of how you would move around. And that was the tethers, which were geostationary satellites with a very strong cable down to Earth, and a little machine climbs up, and of course it's solar powered, it's not got jets, and it lets go of one and it stays still, but the Earth's moving at 27,000 miles an hour, so it gets to New York in a few minutes and it clings onto the New York one and it goes down again. And that isn't possible, obviously, at the moment, because we don't have the materials that could take those strains, but it's not totally improbable. But the two-sided reassurance I got, what was a brilliant physicist that I sat on a judging panel with many years ago, and she read it. She lives in Edinburgh, and she said, "I love the idea of the tethers. That was really intriguing. I've talked to this sort of thing about this sort of thing with my students, and how difficult it would be, but it's not impossible. It's, you know, really good that you use that stuff." She was really flattering. She said, "The only problem you made, because I think I made them like 160 kilometers above the Earth's surface," and she said, "if that was the case, you'd be standing at the bottom waiting for your carriage to come and pick you up. And you'd see a shadow around you that would gradually get bigger until the satellite fell on you." It's not quite high enough. It would have to be about 650 kilometres. You know, so I was only out by like 400 odd kilometres. It wasn't, you know.
It's all right.
Yeah. The conceit of that took me a long time. And I just eventually gave up and went for Wibbly Wobbly, sort of a red dwarf anomaly. But the conceit of getting someone from, it was actually 2011. He'd travelled from 2011 to 2211, and through a kind of energy vortex over Didcot Power Station, which was being closed down. It was very symbolic at the time, a coal-burning power plant that has since been mostly demolished. It has an enormous chimney. So I grew up being able to see that chimney. I lived in rural Oxfordshire, but on the horizon, you could see this red light flashing at night, which was Didcot Power Station. So it was a kind of symbolic image for me. And he goes into the future, 200 years in the future, and we go with him to learn how the worlds work. So there were three alternate realities that he went to. Two sort of benign, one that was really interesting to read out at book readings, the one about where women basically are, we live where it was a matriarchal society. So women are in control, women own stuff, women run the country. And the men are, they really enjoy shopping. I got a lot of criticism from a lot of people, but mostly from women who said it won't work because women would fight too much, which I thought was fascinating. And all the men who listened to it, when I read it out to a mixed audience, bits of it, and discuss it, all the men were going, "Oh God, I'd love to live there," because they looked after the kids, they did the cooking, they raised the children, they read stories, they were always at home, they wore lovely clothes, they looked young until they were much older, they had lovely hair because they looked after it, they had skin products which they would discuss, nice shoes, and the women were stressed and grey and they'd lose their hair and they'd be overweight and depressed and anxious because they had to run the sewage system and the power network and the city and the, you know, and they were all arguing about politics, and that was kind of fun. And it was definitely women said it wouldn't work and men desperately wanted it to work, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I would like to see a world that was run by women, and then I think about the country run by a woman at the moment, and that's not going to
happen. It's not a good example, is it? No. But I mean, I think there have been wonderful examples, and I think historically we'll look back at the kind of shift, because there's now, if you think of sort of global politics and you see a load of those, you know, it will be 55 boring old men in suits standing outside a building, but there'll be six or seven women amongst them. Which, yeah. If you go back even 30 years, there wouldn't be one woman, you know. So there are some, you know, there is a sort of shift taking place. I think, generally speaking, my idea was that you would probably have less war, actual violent war, if it was women. They'd fall out with each other, they'd have terrible rows, they'd be snide and cutting and nasty to each other, but they wouldn't probably start a war. I think that's less likely. You know, that was my only argument. So it was an idea of a world where war just did not exist anymore. And that's the whole, there was a few sequences in it that were in a museum, the Museum of London, because the whole country had become London.
Yeah.
You know, which had the sort of how war was done, and that was a thing that I made up completely out of my stupid brain. Was a woman who evolved a way of neutralizing explosive, an electronic way of splitting the molecule so that it was no longer functioning. So you couldn't use a gun, you couldn't blow anything up, you couldn't, you know, there was no explosive that would function. It was very easy to disable it. And somebody, that was a physicist in MIT, who said they're working on exactly that.
Oh, amazing.
A weapon system that will neutralise explosive. But what will happen is they'll work out an electronic way of neutralising explosives, which also kills people.
Yeah. No, of course they will.
You know, like a ray gun that discombobulates your cells and you just fall into a puddle of goo on the floor.
Yeah, exactly. So there's... But the thing that I was loving so much when I started reading it was that everything was renewable energies. Today, somebody said to me, well, the trouble with renewable energies is we're just not there yet.
I don't know what is, I can't even understand the statement. It's just a statement of the obvious. What you know, you can say, well, I mean, the problem with trees is they grow. Well, is that it? Is that the end of the statement? Yeah, we know they grow. Yeah, well, that's the problem. I mean, they're just going to grow. Well, so we're not there yet means that we're not there yet. I don't know what it means. So what does that mean? We'll never get there? I mean, that's a very brave prediction for the future, which I wouldn't want to agree with. You know, and you could say in, say, 1850, well, this steam stuff's good, but we're not there yet. Well, they got there. You know, it is the most bizarre thing. It's the same with electric cars. Well, they're not there yet. Well, I drive one every day. I've driven to Italy and Sweden in one without any trouble at all. They're there. You know, there's compromises. They're more expensive. But they're there now, and they're coming thick and fast. I mean, what's coming next year is going to be very, you know, a very big shift in the automotive industry. The automotive industry are clearly not planning about what they're selling today. They're planning what they're selling in the next couple of, well, 10 years, but certainly in the next year is a lot coming. So that argument about, you know, like intermittency is a great one. You know, oh, well, we've got to have nuclear base load, otherwise we can't do it. Well, that's so been proved to be incorrect even now. I mean, there are so the examples, and they are few and far between. I'm not going to lie. We're not there yet. But the examples are totally transforming the way we produce and consume energy. So the big batteries, and I'm not just talking lithium-ion, although those are the first ones that have gone in. But when they get to up to grid scale, they do stuff that even the people that built and designed them and designed the software to run them didn't expect them to do. So the speed that they can switch on when there's a problem in the grid, the example that took place in Australia, so a big coal plant effectively blew a fuse and instantly stopped sending power out to the grid. So not like a gradual rundown or it was going wrong, it just went, boop, it went off. And this, we're talking like 7 or 8 gigawatts, I mean, huge amount of electricity going in the grid. So it would immediately cause massive blackouts. All the substations would trip, all the safety systems would kick in. Well, they didn't even notice that had happened. And they had to look back till about 20 minutes later because the battery kicked in and filled that gap only for a few minutes until they were ramping up everything else to take its place. And they didn't know that's what had happened until they looked at the data afterwards, because it came in, because I exaggerated it, and I said a 100,000th of a second on an episode of Fully Charged. It wasn't, it was 700,000th of a second. So slightly longer.
Yeah.
So pretty quick. You know, a lot faster than you can ramp up a gas turbine or do anything else. So no one knew that. Well, what that battery is doing at the moment, because I've just come back from Australia, is making an enormous amount of money. And that will carry on doing that for a few years while we're transitioning, because what it's doing is taking power from a huge wind farm essentially for nothing, holding on to it. And when the price of electricity goes up in a massive spike in the evening in Australia, it sells that electricity. A vast profit. You know, it's thousands and thousands of percent profit it's making, which is, you know, unsustainable in the long term. But it's what it's done now is that a lot of antennas of a lot of bankers, hedge funds, investment people have gone, ooh, batteries make money. Look at the spreadsheet. Look at that. Look how much they made. I mean, that battery will pay, it costs hundreds of millions, and it will pay for itself in about two to three years, they're talking about it will have paid for itself. The key point that I've learned since I've been interviewing people and talking about this is the way we have produced electricity historically and the way we've consumed it historically is we've built a system to cope with the way we consume electricity. So pre-renewables, we build, you know, you build a coal plant and it makes this much electricity. Well, we don't use this much electricity. Depends what time of day. So our I'm going to do it your way around, but our electricity demand is this shape. It's a really weird spike. Every day you get this spike, which in the UK is the evenings. It varies in different countries at different times, but it's from about 4 o'clock till about 7:30 is the peak time. Well, in order to generate that much power, we have to have a lot of extra generating capacity that isn't on the rest of the day. It's not being used, which you then think, oh, that makes sense. That's fair enough. But we're still paying for it. We're paying them deliberately to do nothing. So if you own a gas peaker plant, 90% of its life, it is not running and you're still being paid. It's a really good investment. And what batteries are doing is buggering up that system. It's a very well-established system. There's a whole market that surrounds it. It's not a new thing. It's been like that for many decades. But what batteries are doing is really putting a dent in that because we don't need that. We can cover that peak with the day's renewable generation. So now nobody's putting in a solar farm, for instance, around the world just on its own. They put it in with a huge battery bank as well because then they can supply non-intermittent power. Same with wind farms, so...
Yeah, no, I've just done my first bit of solar stuff, which is just a 60-watt panel on a arbor seat, charging a battery, which is powering the pond filter.
Yeah, brilliant. But what you're not using, I mean, I always say this, you know, my house makes no difference, and your pond pump makes no difference individually. But if a million people had pond pumps like that, the aggregated total of that electricity is measurable by the national grid. That is many, many megawatts a year less that people aren't buying from the national grid. In my case, you know, my electricity bills from last year, from about mid-May till mid-September, were single figures a month. Yeah. And I charge two electric cars. So my annual consumption is way above the average of so what, as I have said in the past, sensible people who have solar panels and a diesel.
What are the two cars you've got?
Well, I've actually got three, but I'm not sure what to do with one of them. I've got a Tesla Model S, which is brilliant, and just more recently a Hyundai Kona. We were very lucky to get one because they only imported 80, so there's not that many around, but they're bringing a lot more in. But the interesting thing is in that 4 year period, so they have roughly the same range. The Tesla's got a slightly bigger battery, but it's a bigger car. So they have about the same range, you know, a genuine 250 miles in the winter, in the wet, with the heater on. So you could do well over that, particularly in the Kona in the summer. But 250 miles is way enough. Yeah, that's the thing. In fact, it's, you know, we've never got close to getting low in the Kona on a long drive. We don't even get near it. You know, we get down to sort of 40%. And then you need a wee. You know, you've got to stop. You've been sitting still for hours, so we plug it in a rapid charger and top it up. But the price difference for buying them, that when I got that Tesla, I mean, they're both on a lease, but if I'd paid paid for it up front, it would have been about 67,000 quid for the Model S 4 years ago. The Kona, when we got it, was 32,000. So in that 4 year period, that's the price difference. Same range, pretty close. I suppose the Tesla's faster. Yeah, no, the Tesla's faster. The Tesla's kind of what it is. And the Kona is like a sensible, normal car that is actually useful. Because doing 0 to 60 in under 3 seconds isn't that useful.
No, it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about range anxiety, because it is something that everybody, as well, you said yourself, you know, everybody who doesn't have an electric car thinks about range anxiety. If you have one, you don't. Why don't you?
You certainly do when you first get one. I mean, the first time I drove that little IME from Birmingham to my house, which is, I think, about 63 miles, and particularly the last three, I was very anxious about, because it's all up quite a long, steep hill. I was going... And I was actually sweating. I was on the M5 coming down from Birmingham, and there was actual sweat running down, because I just went, this is going to stop any minute. And I'm on the way, what am I going to do? Oh, my God. Terrible. And then I got home and I went, oh, and it was, because that one had fairly limited range. It was extremely low, but because I didn't know what would happen when it got that low. I'd never driven it before. So that was, yeah, I think the first time you drive an electric car on your own, not a test drive from a garage, you know, but you're going somewhere in one, you'll go, oh my God, will it get there? So then the next step is learning how to charge it. And not, it's not, learning, I mean, that takes 2 seconds. How do you plug it in? There, that it goes in there, all right. The charging infrastructure is still, it's not there yet. And it's still extremely annoying on occasions, but it's improving very rapidly. So, you know, because when people say, oh, there's no charging infrastructure. When I had that iMeV, there was literally one rapid charger in the country, which is at Mitsubishi's offices. And 9 times out of 10, it didn't work. And all the instructions were in Japanese, and no one at Mitsubishi could speak Japanese. So that was challenging when there's one in the whole country. So there's now, I think, something like 22,000 over the whole country, spread out all over the motorways. You know, there's lots and lots of hotels, shopping centres, car parks. That's coming. And what will be the step that is interestingly European legislation, but I think it will be adopted in this country, whatever happens, is that your car is recognised, because the car and the charger communicate. So the cable you plug in is power, but it's also communications. And the charger recognises the car. So how Tesla do it. So you plug a Tesla in, if you don't have free supercharging, you plug a Tesla in, the charger knows which car it is, whose account it is. So you have an account on the screen like you would with a phone, and you plug it in and it starts charging, and you pay for it, but you don't have to do anything. You plug it in and it charges. And I've used a few of those chargers in Europe where once it knows the car, it knows I have an account. You just drive in, you put the plug in and you walk away, you don't even look, and it just starts charging straight away. And that's what it's got to be like. So, you know, that technology now is being adopted by more and more people, because we've been through this painful period where you have to have a card and a card reader, or you have to have an app, you know, and you have to do, and they are frail. Those communication systems are easily broken. You want a hardwired, really solid system that recognizes the car. It's really the only solution. I mean, the next best one is, thankfully, some people are doing tap to pay. So you have, like you buy a bottle of fizzy pop, you tap your card on it and it starts charging. Well, at least that makes it simpler. So that's got to be there. So, but once you can do that, then you do longer journeys and you go, oh, right. You know, I think first long journey I did in the Tesla was to Scotland. And I went, oh my God, that's, you know, because it's like, I don't know what, 380 miles. Oh, and there's a charger there, right on the motorway. Okay, I'll charge it there. And I had a cup of tea, and then I went, oh, it's full. Oh, I'll carry on. You know, it charged much faster than it took me to go in, have a wee, have a cup of tea, read the newspaper, go check the... And on a Tesla, the app is really good, tells you how much is charged, how much the car's charged. So you get used to it. And then we drove all over Europe in it without any trouble at all. But that is Tesla's supercharger network, which gives Teslas a very unfair advantage, because that is... You don't have to plan anything. I put the final address, an Italian address, in to the sat-nav, and it worked out the route via superchargers all the way down through France, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. You know, it was really easy.
It sort of feels like the mindset of the petrol engine driver is you drive it till it's empty and then you fill it up again, whereas I feel like that's not what you do.
No. I've certainly done that. You know, you've done it where I've gone, whew. I mean, we did it in Netherlands last year, where I ended up at a charger with 14 miles range left in a Jag I-Pace. I didn't know what was going to happen in that last 40. You know, when we had like 40 kilometres left, I was going, oh, it's 14 kilometres range. Yeah. And I didn't know how close it, you know, you're going, oh, this is quite touch, you know. So there are those moments, but that's very unusual. I mean, generally, because that's people say, how long does it take to charge? It's impossible to say, because, you know, there are only one time ever I've made a car run out. So I still have a Nissan Leaf, the original Nissan Leaf, and I drove it till it stopped to see what happened. I was filming it. And it was really boring because it took much longer than I expected to run out, but it did do it in the end, and it stops just like a petrol car. And I'd arranged with the local garage, so they had a tow truck ready, and I said, I'll ring you. And in fact, it stopped finally when I was about 50 metres outside their gate, so it was very easy, very easy solution. But then I pushed it, got carried back to my house, we pushed it into the garage, I plugged it in, left it, and it took all night to charge. Well, that was a good example. If it's totally empty so that you can't even drive it, it takes about, that car took about eight and a half hours to charge up again. So that's once in 10 years of driving electric cars. Generally, you get to somewhere and you've got 25, 30, 40%. Well, then it takes, on a rapid charger, 20 minutes and you can do another 150 kilometres further. You know, so it's impossible to say. And if I plug my Tesla Model S into a 3-pin domestic socket, which you can do, I've done it on a few occasions, it takes about a day. So if you're waiting in the rain to charge a car and you want to do a Jeremy Clarkson special, that's the way to do it. Plug it into a 3-pin and literally stand by it crying while diesel Range Rovers roar past.
Okay, listen, so if people want to find out more about electric cars, there's an event they can go to.
There is an event they can go to that is very exciting. It's the second year. So if you didn't come to last year's, you're very lucky, because last year's was for the early adopters, because it was a bit chaotic. I think we ran out of food at about 11:30 on the first day. But a lot of people came, which was very exciting. So this year it's much better organised, it's much bigger. It's called Fully Charged Live. It's at Silverstone on the 7th, 8th and 9th of June. It will have on display every electric car that is available in the UK, plus hundreds of other, literally, I mean, real piles of other cars, not piles, nicely ordered displays of amazing classic cars that have been converted, beautifully done. I mean, really high-end conversions of, you know, from a Volkswagen Beetle to a Ferrari, to cover the whole gamut. An electric DeLorean that is incredibly high performance, much, much faster than the original. I mean, all of them are fun. There's a Volkswagen Beetle that will be there that is terrifying. The speed of it is just mind-boggling. But then there's loads of electric bikes, electric vans, buses. You're very likely, if you turn up in a fossil-burning car, which most people do, because that's what most people have got in the car parks, you'll be transferred from the car park to the venue either in a Tesla or in an electric bus, or a whole series of electric buses, because there's a lot of the Tesla Owners Club of Great Britain really enjoy doing this. And there is an enormous amount of them coming this year. So it will be Tesla-tastic. That was a big highlight for a lot of kids last year, because they got their first ride in a Tesla, and the Owners Club are under very strict instructions not to use ludicrous mode on the very narrow support roads that go around Silverstone, because there was a bit of that last year. It was very popular, but just, you know, we had to be a bit careful. But yeah, no, and amazing food, really wide range of food, and even on the Saturday, live music.
Oh, that's pretty
bonkers, yeah.
And you got some scientists there as well.
Got proper, oh yeah, and then the kind of key thing is the talk. So we did get, I mean, they're just, well, the people we had last year, amazing. We got, and the people we got this year, incredible, and in sort of dedicated theatre spaces, so it'd be much easier to hear them. And I was kind of sceptical about how much people would be interested in that, but last year, every single talk was jam-packed to the walls. It was absolutely amazing. And we had really, really good people, really clever people that actually know, they know these things called facts. They're really weird. Not like vague opinions that I have.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. Well, I'm going to be there, and I'm sure lots of the Cosmic Shed listeners will be there too. But
what everyone said last year, what was great, was to be in a place where it just felt very optimistic and uplifting, and it kind of cheered. But a lot of people had a really good time, so it was, yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. And are you writing anything at the moment?
Well, we're actually, that's what I was doing this morning, is going over the manuscript. So we're publishing the Fully Charged Almanac, but it's been retitled. So your listeners are the first people to know this, because you've only just agreed to do it. And the thing is, I can't remember what the title is. The Fully Charged Book of Electric Vehicles and Renewable Energy. It's something like, it's better than that.
Okay, cool.
There's about 24 different people who've written it from different fields. And that's the same as the talks, in a way. There's an introduction from me with a vague opinion, and then there's some people who know actual facts. I'm really thrilled with it. Because it was a bit of a punt to, will it work? Will anybody be? I think it will be a historic document, And it's definitely not looking at what has happened or what's happening this year. It's what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years. So it's a prediction of, the changes that are to come in the near future.
What are you excited about electric car-wise in the future?
I've always been a bit of a skeptic regarding fully autonomous cars. And not because I think they won't work technologically. I've been in 3 now, and they were all really impressive. They were good, but it's the sort of human aspect of that, and also the legal and insurance that aspect of it. No one's come up with anything except for one suggestion I had heard, which was a company in America that are developing. They're developing the technology that's behind it. So they weren't an automotive manufacturer. They were people who do all the software and that. But their idea was, in the next 20 years, no one will go around in the general public roads in being driven by an autonomous car. But what you will be able to do really much sooner is you'll be in a city or a suburb or anywhere, and you'll press your car button on your whatever phone you've got, and a car will arrive at your house really quickly, no one in it. Then you get in it, the steering wheel appears. Now, when you see those cars, I've seen them, where you sit in the car and the thing comes out of a completely blank dashboard, and there's a steering wheel. You go, wow, that's cool. And then you drive it. So you're insured, you're covered, it's your responsibility. If something goes wrong, it's your fault. And then you get out of the car and it drives itself away. You don't have to park it. You don't have to have an MOT or insurance or tax or, all that stuff. Or charge it. It will go away and charge itself. And I've already seen, that is totally technically doable now. I've already seen cars drive into a car park, park themselves, and they start charging. That's not even new. That's been around for a while. So that notion where you don't own cars, I think, is the most exciting thing. Because if we didn't own cars, but we still had exactly the same access at exactly the same times that we do now, we'd need 80% less cars in the world. Someone's done the maths. And because I've got 2 cars. Well, actually, my wife's out in one, but we've got 2 cars here. No one's using them. They're sitting dormant for 90% of the time. And that is a completely universally accepted... It's the only universally accepted statistic I've ever heard out of the automotive industry is 90-90, which is 90% of the time, 90% of the world's functioning on the road legal cars aren't in use.
Wow.
Which is good, because if they all were in use, we'd be stuffed. I think it's generational as well. I think it's going to be, anyone who's under 30 now, I think, would accept that quite readily. Anyone who's over 30, I like having my own car. It says something about me. And as I always say, what a car says about you 9 times out of 10 is you're a tosser. Doesn't matter what the car is.
Yeah.
When I get out of my Ferrari Testarone, whatever the twat, those stupid bloody cars, when I see a man my age get out of a ridiculously expensive sports car, I don't think, wow, he's cool. Never. No. In fact, I've never seen anyone get out of a car and think, oh, aren't they cool? Aren't they sexy? Aren't they wonderful? I always think, oh, you pillock.
Listen, this has been wonderful.
No, good to talk to you. Thank you. And hopefully I'll see you at Fully Charged Live. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you so much to Robert for talking to me. And hopefully I'll be talking to some of the people there at Fully Charged Live for the Physics World Stories podcast, which I also host. But hopefully see some of you there. If you see me wandering around with a microphone, do come and say hello.
And we've got some episodes in the bag which I should tell you about. We've done one on The Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind. We've got someone from Aardman Animations to talk all things Godzilla. And we're going to be talking about computer games with Dr. Peter Etchells, who studies the effect that computer games have on our minds. And looks into that, some of those news stories which suggest that computer games aren't good for us in some way. And, I'll let you listen to what Peter says in that forthcoming episode of The Cosmic Shed. And thank you very much for listening. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.